Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Church Beneath the Roots by Felix Blackwell. Narrated by Gary Tiedemann. Prologue, 1968. Captain Hank Freeze eyed his co-pilot with growing concern. First Officer Ted Lombardi hadn't checked his flight instruments in a while, nor heeded the intermittent radio chatter. Instead, he tapped a nauseating belch from his chest, then resumed the unconscious fumbling of the rock his son had given him. He'd been turning the object over in his hand for the past 15 minutes, as if praying on a rosary.
"Stomach still bothering you?" Hank asked.
"Just isn't sitting right," Ted replied, shifting uncomfortably in his chair. "Not since camping. Might have been those sandwiches we brought along. Ham seemed on its way out."
The stone's peculiar surface glimmered in the morning light, casting a rainbow across the flight deck. The longer Hank looked at it, the dizzier he became. And yet, he found himself staring into it for longer and longer intervals.
"You find that up in the mountains?" Hank asked,
mesmerized by the richness of the stone's color. He'd never seen a black so pure. His eyes unfocused into the little void it appeared to rip in Ted's hand. Hank imagined himself falling in.
"Yeah," said Ted, swallowing hard. "Jason found it on the hike. I figured he'd want to keep it, but he gave it to me before I left this morning. Said it would keep me safe."
"He's still worried about you flying?"
Hank asked, quickly glancing at the altimeter and then returning his gaze to the stone. Ted snorted in amusement, but the motion seemed to cause a bolt of pain to arc through his abdomen. He dropped a hand onto his belly and looked over at Hank, noticing the captain's fixation with the stone.
"Last night, he dreamed about a crash," Ted said. "He's prone to nightmares. It's always something."
"That's a shame," Hank replied. "You should bring him up here one of these days. Show him how boring the job really is."
Ted tried to speak, but a groan of discomfort came out instead. Beads of sweat collected on his brow, and he tugged at the collar of his uniform.
"Listen, why don't you hit the lavatory?" Hank said, finally looking up at his co-pilot's face. "I'll call Lila up here with some water and crackers if need be. Better out than in, man."
Ted's eyes darted around the flight deck as if he'd only now realized he was on an airplane. His breath hastened, and his neck visibly quivered with the pounding of his heart. He continued turning the stone in his hand.
"You think we turn out like our fathers, Captain?"
he asked, ignoring Hank's suggestion.
"You know, the good and the bad."
"Not sure I get your meaning," Hank replied, losing his train of thought.
His eyes grew heavy, studying Ted, and their weight pulled his attention back down to the stone. It was a lovely, jagged thing, not some common pebble fished out of a creek. Its black seemed to emanate from an impossible distance. In a few moments, he became lost in it again.
"Do we become them's what I mean?" Ted went on,
wincing in pain as he spoke.
"Is it inside you all along?"
"Inside you," Hank echoed, watching every movement of Ted's fingers as they glided over the stone. He imagined snatching the thing away, and how good it must feel to hold.
"Little kids,"
Ted blurted out, his voice a flood of sorrow.
Just bad thoughts, more and more."
Hank barely registered the strange admission. All he could do was fixate upon the weird rock.
"I swear, I never touched them, though," Ted went on. "I couldn't live with myself."
"Oh, yeah,"
Hank mumbled absently.
"Kids are great."
His mind wandered to a place it had never been before, and teetered there at the edge of awareness. Then, suddenly, every thought and memory and desire within Hank collapsed all at once into the darkness of the stone.
he could no longer resist. Hank reached out and took it for himself, surprised that Ted seemed to give it up willingly. The moment it rolled into his palm, a strange feeling washed over him, some revolting decoction of fear and lust.
"I try to ignore it,"
Ted continued, squirming in his chair while he spoke.
"But I feel it growing bigger. Makes me sick, sick all the time now."
He palpated his belly with a hand, as if searching his guts for a thing that did not belong.
"I don't want to be like him, Hank. I hate my father."
Ted's voice receded with the rest of the world as Hank lost himself in the stone. After peering into its depths long enough, he began to perceive distant lights within it, lonely stars trembling in the furthest reaches of space. They whirled into strange constellations and blinked in and out of existence.
"I'm afraid of the hunger,"
said Ted, his voice breaking with emotion.
"Afraid of the ache. Even now, I feel it rotting me from the inside."
Hank gasped when his thumb came down on the bladed edge of the stone. It sliced deep, almost to the bone, but no pain came screaming across his hand. Instead, every bad feeling in Hank's body escaped with the blood running down his wrist, and the spreading warmth made him realize how cold he'd been all these years. His heart raced, and his breath quickened at the immense pleasure overtaking him. He examined the wound, and a thought occurred to him that felt like the answer to all of life's great questions. It felt divinely inspired. A revelation. Hank turned to his co-pilot with wild eyes.
"You want me to see if I can get it out?"
A long silence hung in the air. A sense of spiritual harmony pervaded the flight deck, and grins spread across both men's faces. Ted looked at the stream pouring down Hank's arm, and at the stone that had caused the wound.
"Oh, God, yes,"
he finally said, wiping away the sweat that now dribbled down his brow.
"Can you really?"
Hank nodded with joyful confidence. He sliced his own finger again, this time in demonstration, and then gently pushed Ted back in his chair.
"Just hold still."
Hank unbuttoned Ted's shirt, exposing a roiling belly. He ran his fingers across Ted's abdomen as he'd done to the stone, beholding it with the same sense of wonderment. He traced a bloody symbol onto the skin.
"Wait!"
Ted cried out as Hank prepared to make an incision. He pointed a shaking hand at Hank's face.
"How can you see like that?"
Another long silence filled the air. Both men burst into laughter, and then quickly shushed each other, as if trying to keep a hilarious secret.
"You're right,"
Hank said, realizing his mistake. He looked down at the stone for a moment, then plunged it into his eye with a twisting motion. Kaleidoscopic patterns of light and color exploded across his vision. Hank could now see more clearly into the void.
"Mother of God,"
he said, looking around the flight deck in awe. The sight returned him across long years to the innocence of boyhood, and there he felt a comfort he'd since learned to live without.
"I'm home."
Ted's snickering grew to uncontrollable laughter. With his remaining eye, Hank could see drops of sweat flying off Ted's face with each bellow.
"Oh, shit,"
Ted said, now clutching his stomach to prevent it from bursting.
I think I hear it."
Mad babble erupted from his lips, and his tongue wagged around his mouth as if trying to escape on a forgotten curse. Hank sliced into his other eye, methodically prying back the rest of the veil that had obscured his vision all these years. He rued the lifetime he'd wasted as a blind man, but at least now he could see the shape of Ted's soul, the sickness upon it, and the endless vistas of darkness cradling the two of them and everyone else on the plane. "Now I see," Hank crooned. "I see it, Ted." He loomed over the feverish man, soothing him with a hand to the cheek. Hank listened to the prayer Ted had begun to recite, a thing morose and indecipherable, uttered through him from across the dark. "I hear it," Ted cried out between the strings of guttural nonsense. "It's a song." "I hear it too, my friend," Hank replied, stroking the co-pilot's hair and beholding the illness that festered within him. He thrust the stone into Ted, slicing through his abdomen in the shape of the bloody symbol he'd drawn. "They're singing for us, buddy." The sensation of cutting into Ted's body was transcendent for Hank. He felt the calamities of his soul called to order with each thrust. All his life had led up to this single act. It was his ultimate purpose, and he would be judged on it alone. He needed to remove all the pain and sadness from Ted to make room for the joy of salvation. As he reached inside to retrieve the malady that had affixed itself to the first officer, the prayer grew louder, both on Ted's voice and the ones chanting from the void. Brilliant, warm colors erupted from his spirit, showering Hank and the lightless cosmos around him while he ripped and tore at the infection. Everything was wet. Ted screamed with ineffable passion now, unleashing verse upon verse of the song coming through him. It resonated inside of Hank, empowering him to do the work he was destined to do. The noises attracted the attention of the passengers in the cabin, their worried voices harmonizing beautifully with Ted's melodic prayers. The plane began to buck and snort over waves of turbulence, and Hank reveled in its soothing rhythm. Stewardess Lila Jackson poked her head into the flight deck. "What in the Sam hell are you boys on about in here?" she asked, and then fell silent while she took in the scene. Hank looked up at her, watching the terror gather on her face in radiant swirls. He could see through her as well, every emotion, every secret, every burden. He would help her with all of those. But first, he had to finish helping Ted. The first officer now lay quiet in his chair, head bouncing lifelessly with each shudder of the plane. Hank craned over him, slowly removing and inspecting various things he'd excised from Ted's abdomen. Organic wonders dangled from every console, hung carefully to align with the stars that guided Hank. Rivulets of glowing liquid dripped from them and covered Hank's face and arms. Its warmth felt orgasmic. Unable to speak, Lila instead croaked in horror, drawing Hank's attention. He looked up at her again, now cradling a snarl of Ted's illness in his hands. When he extended it to her as an offering, she found her voice and screamed. "Yes, that's it," Hank said. "They want us to sing too." Lila fell backward out of the flight deck, crashing into the bulkhead behind her. She turned and fled, but Hank could see her no matter where she went. He could see everything now. Hank turned to the control panel and set the plane to a moderate descent. Then he stood up and hung the infected viscera around his shoulders, imagining himself adorned in the vestments of a priest. By the light of the stars, he would consecrate this plane and everyone on it. He would free these poor souls from the disease of mortality. Hank barged into the cabin and was met with the ghastly noises of his passengers. They too were becoming aware of the truths he'd discovered through the black stone, and now a few of them were praying and shrieking. Their eyes rolled back in their heads, no doubt from the immensity of their dark revelations, and they clawed at their own faces or pulled at each other's hair. Those unaffected around them looked on in fear, and when they beheld Hank's new eyes, they too began to scream. Hank gripped the stone like a lancet in one hand and urged for calm with the other. He shushed the man closest to him and said in a gentle voice, "Don't be afraid, my dear. You won't feel a thing." He then slashed the man's throat in one rapid flourish, baptizing the nearby passengers in the lustrous fluid that erupted from the wound. Although they screamed, the dying man himself looked up at Hank with an expression of relief and smiled wide-eyed as he crumpled in his seat.
"Be purified," Hank cried out. "Throw off this wretched flesh."
He drifted down the aisle, gazing into the souls of the passengers and longing to free them from the prisons of their bodies. Hank laughed as passengers attacked one another, as they prayed in nameless tongues, and as they cowered in fear at the sight of him. And they too began to laugh, until the entire plane filled with the music of the void. Two men grabbed hold of Lila, who had been crouched in a terrified ball at the back of the plane, and dragged her toward Hank. He peered deeply into Lila's eyes. Hidden galaxies swirled behind them, begging to be discovered. "You'll see too," he said in a nurturing tone. "Here, let me help you." The men held Lila's head while she screamed in protest. But before Hank could relieve her of her blindness, a voice called out from behind him.
"Choose us,"
a young woman said, rising from her seat. She wore a tranquil expression and gazed fearlessly into Hank's new eyes. Her hands moved slowly over her pregnant belly, and inside it, Hank could see a most luminous soul, shared between a set of twin girls.
"Remarkable," he said breathlessly,
forgetting the stewardess and turning to face the pregnant woman.
"Truly a gift from God."
The woman moved past her convulsing husband and came face to face with Hank. The plane shuddered furiously as it descended through a cloud bank. In the cockpit, alarms blared.
"Teach us," the woman said, unblinking. "Teach us to sing."
Part 1. Dreams. Chapter 1. 1968. It was once believed that some caves in the Rocky Mountains are passageways to other realms, open only to the dead. Were a living person to enter one of these, they risked falling into Knuth Soka'an, the void between worlds, where even the spirit is forgotten. But the ones who told of this left the Rockies long ago, having fled the region after an age of brutal winters. Other people have since come and gone, weaving their own legends about the mysterious tunnels. Down through the centuries, the caves of Pale Peak and its mountain neighbors have earned a particularly sinister reputation. They are said to cause fright and wonder in anyone who dares peer inside, and even hunger like winter wolves for the souls of the living.
Their mouths whisper to passers-by with promises of irresistible delight, and the mysteries of their depths call out to faraway children in their beds. As a boy, Anway Lopez had dreamed of the cave near his family's reservation on Pale Peak. He'd seen it in person while hiking with his father up to Mirror Lake, but he'd never stopped to inspect it. Anway remembered the legends his father had told him about the cave, of wild animals and bandits and vengeful spirits, and heeded his warning never to explore it. But in the dead of night, that maw of rock and all its pregnant darkness loomed in Anway's mind. He dreamed of following his old man inside, and of shadowy things dragging him down into a bottomless chasm. He dreamed of undiscovered riches beneath the earth, and of lost, precious heirlooms of his people waiting to be reclaimed. As the decades passed, that cave became a thing of grim curiosity, feeling at once repulsive and alluring. Anway grew up, but he never ceased to wonder. Now, as he walked in the shadow of Pale Peak, Anway realized the dreams had returned. Fragments of a nightmare came to him over the duration of his hike, and as he passed through forest and field, he tried to assemble the pieces. He remembered a boy and a copse of trees and something moving in the distance. A storm, however, washed the color out of the world, and all of it blurred together in the fraying of memory. Just like in his dream, today was dark and wet. The mountain's icy breath seeped through the pines all around Anway, nipping at his ears and jangling the various charms affixed to his old hiking staff. It was late autumn now, and though the first snows were still weeks away, a month of rain had pummeled the land to a soggy pulp. The season had been unusually wet, and each squall seemed to portend the bitter winter to come. Up ahead trotted Numi, a precocious husky mix who loved the outdoors even more than her owner did. She sniffed every rock and flower and ran circles around the trees in fruitless attempts at catching the chicories that scrabbled over their branches. Throughout the 8 years of her life, she and Anway had explored almost all of the mountain and its foothills, except the western face, whose terrain was treacherous and shrouded in dark woods. Today's journey would take them to Ash Hill, which rose above that eerie forest and offered a view of the distant mountains beyond it. It was a place for days that demanded a particular solitude. There, Anway could escape his troubles, at least for a little while. Normally, the hike to get there was about an hour, but today it had taken more than two. Anway hardly paid attention to the trail as he wandered. Instead, he focused on the dream until its pieces came together and a little story played out. The boy tugged Anway's arm with one hand and gestured at a nearby tree with the other. Something dangled in it, twisting in a hateful wind. The boy had dread in his expression, but it wasn't clear if it was the swaying object upsetting him or the structure in the distance behind it.
Lonan,
the boy called out. Father. Anway rubbed his eyes, trying to remember what had stood just beyond the tree. He thought at first it might have been a house, but it could have been a statue or a cave. The faster he cycled through the images in his memory, the quicker they faded, and eventually, Anway's mind returned to his surroundings. The dream vanished like mist on the morning slopes. Anway had had this nightmare many times before, or at least variants of it. He knew the boy was Akantha, his best friend from childhood, and he sensed that Akantha wanted to show him something, but Anhwe always woke up before he could discern the thing through the heaving woods. After all these years, it remained obscured in the place just beyond the edge of his memory. And what had Akantha meant by father? More than 2 decades had passed since the boy's disappearance, but the dreams rarely abated. At the worst times, they were terrifying, haunting Anhwe in the dark of his home and weighing ceaselessly on his thoughts. He'd tried his best at interpreting the ones he could make sense of, and he'd scoured the wilderness for any place that looked like the tree line from his dreams. Alas, the forests and rock formations of Pale Peak all pretty much looked the same, and no amount of exploring had unraveled the mystery that had brought Anhwe's life to ruin. The question echoed in his mind today, as it had since 1944. What happened to Akantha Riverstone? Numi's cheerful yipping pulled Anhwe back to the present. She approached her master and gazed up into his eyes, perhaps noticing something was bothering him. He gave her a strong pat, which sent her zipping off down the trail in excitement, then bounding back to him again. As they rounded the bend, the pines thinned, and a grassy hill came into view against a gray sky.
"Looks like you found it," Anhwe said to the dog.
He quickened after her, his spirit renewed by the sight of an important landmark. By the time he reached the top of the hill, Numi was already rolling around in the grass, dirtying the white of her coat. Anhwe gave her some water from his canteen, then leaned against his hiking staff and took in the view. Emerald grass fluttered in the wind all around him, and a dozen yards ahead, the hill dropped off sharply toward a tree line far below. That was the edge of a woodland he'd never explored, and he prayed it was not where Akantha had gone all those years ago.
"Bears out there," Anhwe's father used to say, trying to scare him as a boy. "Biggest ones around. Man-eaters."
Long ago, Anhwe had spent many mornings here with his father, sitting on a fallen log and trading stories or practicing the old language. It was one of the few places he could still feel his dad's presence, and so Anhwe had named the hill after him. With those memories embedded in the landscape, he could call upon his father's wisdom with each visit and be united with him through their mutual love of the outdoors. Truly, Ash Hill was a beautiful place, not least for its spiritual aspect. The wild woods below sprawled out to a horizon of distant, jagged peaks tearing at the open sky. All around, rock formations jutted from the earth, which had served as fortresses for Anhwe and his childhood friends. High above, the forbidding peak towered over the land, casting much of it in shadow. A rush of wind set the world shivering around Anhwe, and, for just a moment, chased away the dreary thoughts of all the people he'd lost. But then, a mechanical sound arose, the roar of distant engines. Numi's ears perked up, and she jumped to her feet in search of the noise. It changed in pitch as it approached, and through the clouds overhead appeared a small jet. It sputtered against the choppy air and pitched back and forth on its axis, surely thrashing the poor souls on board. Anhwe had seen plenty of aircraft pass over the mountain through the years, but none before had ever come this low, nor flown so erratically. The plane's awkward glide turned to a spiraling dive, heralded by a shriek of its engines. It plummeted hundreds of feet in a matter of seconds, filling the valley with a hideous noise as it cut against the wind. "Holy shit," Anhwe said, already feeling in his body what his brain didn't want to admit. This plane was going down. A moment later, it slammed into the earth in a burst of flame. The explosion echoed across the mountain, terrifying Numi and sending hundreds of birds soaring into the air,
Sample complete. Ready to continue?